Welcome to the NFID podcast, Infectious Ideas. This is Marla Dalton, NFID Executive Director and CEO. And with me is my co-host, Dr. Bill Schaffner. Bill, it is always wonderful to have you.
A pleasure, Marla, as always.
Our guest today is Dr. Celine Gounder, an internist, infectious disease specialist, epidemiologist, and nationally known public health communicator. She is a CBS News medical contributor, a senior fellow at Kaiser Family Foundation, and editor-at-large for public health at KFF Health News. She is also a clinical associate professor of medicine and infectious diseases at New York University's Grossman School of Medicine, and she cares for patients on the wards at Bellevue Hospital Center. Trained at Princeton, Johns Hopkins, University of Washington, and Harvard, she is a leading expert in science, medicine, and public health communication. She is perhaps best known for her coverage of health inequities and epidemics related to topics such as COVID, Ebola, Zika, mental health, and disinformation. She is a member of the National Academy of Medicine and has been included on the lists of 50 women making the world a better place, as well as 25 women changing the world, for her contributions to public health and healthcare. Celine, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be here.
As fellow podcast hosts, Bill and I were just remarking that we have featured some of the same rock star guests, including Tony Fauci, Rochelle Walensky, Tom Frieden, and Peter Hotez. I guess the rock star list is small in the infectious disease space. I'm curious, though, although you were trained as a physician and an epidemiologist, what really led you to pivot towards a career and a successful career in journalism?
Yeah, this goes back to about 2012. I was an assistant commissioner of health at the New York City Department of Health. And this is in the aftermath of the 08-09 recession, sequestration, massive cuts to public health funding. And in that position I had in New York, I was having to let go of 20% of the staff in my bureau in 1 year, with further reductions in funding and layoffs in subsequent years projected. And was really frustrated with the situation and really came to the conclusion that without being able to educate the public about public health, without the public understanding what is public health and the value of public health, it was always going to be a battle to get taxpayer funding to support these programs at the level that they really need, and to also address this boom-bust cycle that we see in public health, where lots of money gets dumped in when there's a crisis and then gets pulled out, precisely what we've seen with COVID again, and there's not long-term infrastructure being built. So my layoff plan, as I told Commissioner Farley at the time, was I'm laying myself off. And I took off 6 months to figure out what next. I had never taken time off since college. I just plowed straight through and felt like this was a good time to step back and take stock and figure out what next. And what I realized in that process was there was a through line in work I was doing. It wasn't journalism per se. It was different forms of science communication. And some of this was in D.C. My first job out of college was working for Ralph Nader, the consumer advocate. He had taken an interest in tuberculosis and malaria, and so spent a year working with him on briefing folks on the Hill and the executive branch on that. And then later in my work in HIV and TB in Southern Africa, we get pulled in to moderating town halls or briefing local journalists and the like. And then back in the U.S., would be asked by the Infectious Disease Society of America and others to do briefings in D.C. for congressional staffers. And I just came to see that was a through line from the beginning and is a specific skill set, and decided that I was going to focus on that as there being a unique skill set that I had and also the need.
Well, it certainly has worked out very successfully for you, Celine. And speaking of one of your stories, we've previously spoken with CDC Director Bill Foege and with vaccine expert Walt Ornstein about their experiences as smallpox warriors. Now, you recently traveled to South Asia to talk with Rahima Banu, the last person in the world known to have contracted a naturally occurring case of variola major, the deadly form of smallpox. So what did you learn from her, and why was it so important to tell her story?
I think for a number of reasons, to tell her story, to tell the story of smallpox, while we still have people like Bill Foege and others who were leaders in that smallpox eradication program, while we still have them around, I think we heard a lot about, quote, trusted messengers during the COVID pandemic and the importance of enlisting them in communication efforts. And many times, trusted messengers, whether it's COVID or HIV or some other disease, they're very often people who themselves have been affected by the disease, or maybe their family members have. And it's very difficult to enlist people like that if you can't have a trusting relationship with them to begin with. And I think part of the story of Rahima Bandu is over the years, she's been approached many times by people from the World Health Organization and other global health groups to include her in their messaging. And at the same time, she feels in some ways exploited by that and questions what has she benefited from? After all, she had smallpox herself. One could argue her children will never have smallpox, but she herself did have smallpox, right? And she continues to struggle with poverty, with poor health. And so when you go to approach people to enlist as your trusted messengers, there has to be something that you're giving in return as part of that relationship. It can't be a one-way relationship. And I think she's just a great case study of oftentimes with these big public health programs, people are left behind in very difficult ways.
Yeah. And you do remind me that we infectious disease doctors take care of patients during their acute illness. But once they're discharged, we have much less information about their subsequent life and if they are left with disabilities or in circumstances such as Rahima Bandu. We're much less knowledgeable about that. And so thank you for that story. It's very important.
With HIV, we have the privilege of really accompanying somebody throughout a lifelong chronic disease. There are other kinds of patients who, perhaps a gunshot wound patient, where they have osteomyelitis and they might have paralysis leading to chronic urinary tract infections. There are certain kinds of patients we do get to have those longer term experiences with. But for much of infectious diseases, you're right, Bill, that we don't always have those long term relationships.
So I'm going to shift gears a little bit now back towards COVID. And we all know that here in the U.S., even life expectancy has decreased since the pandemic. And we see the biggest drop now among non-Hispanic American Indians and Alaska Natives. So I know that your prior work has highlighted the context and history underlying these disparities. I'm curious what you've learned about why Indigenous people in particular have been hit so hard by COVID and other diseases.
For a number of different reasons, a lot of this is socioeconomic. And if you look at, for example, housing, you're much more likely to see dense housing. In other words, many people living in the same home, sharing a bedroom, multi-generational housing. And some of this goes back to red tape, bureaucratic red tape, legal red tape that makes it very difficult to build new housing on Indian reservations and to bring utilities like water and electricity to Indian reservations. So we don't always think about those things as health, but that leads to these living conditions that increases the risk of transmission. So that's certainly a big part of it. And then on top of that, you have people whose original forms of livelihood have largely been taken away from them because they have been displaced. Their indigenous ways of eating have changed. You have a history of food packages that have been provided to indigenous people. And very often those food supplements or rations have not been healthy and have created new traditions of less healthy eating. You go to, say, the Navajo reservation in the Southwest, and it's a massive food desert as well. And so to access good, healthy food is very difficult. So when you drill down on all the various different social determinants of health, and I've just mentioned a handful here, you really have pre-existing conditions that predict that if you're going to be hit with something like COVID, where both the socioeconomics and the chronic diseases associated with those put you at higher risk for both infection and then severe disease, it really is going to be devastating for a community like that.
I'm going to go back to the pandemic. Throughout that pandemic period, USELINE played a valuable role as a science communicator, from reporting on new developments in vaccine science to addressing misinformation propagated by social media. Now, that's something that bothers many of us, myself included. Do you have any advice to help us crack the code on how to engage people with the right information and reduce the spread of disinformation? I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I think at an individual level, I think the most important thing is, how do you communicate in a way that you're trusted? And I think all too often, doctors and scientists and other people in the health professions think, I just need to provide good information, evidence-based information, in a clear and simple way. And that is simply not enough. 99% of messaging is, are you trusted? And are you trusted is, do you show that you care about somebody? And are you showing curiosity? Are you listening? And so a lot of that communication is actually, are you listening and asking people about their concerns? And that kind of thing is also difficult to do in mass media. That's something that works much better, say, in a local community meeting or something like that, or in a doctor's office. But that is 99% of, quote, cracking the code. And so this is, I think, one of the reasons why many of the professional organizations are hammering home the importance of clinicians having those conversations with their patients, because that is not something you can do at scale. It has to be often one by one. But I think that's really the most important piece of it, is that trust.
I really think that's good advice. We're going to have to keep trying to do it through the mass media, because the mass media are there. But as you say, that's a greater challenge.
Mm-hmm. We need to be where the people are, clearly. Speaking of that, I know that this topic really became so much more personal to you after the tragic death of your husband. It must have been devastating to see that tragedy used to spread misinformation. But fortunately, you spoke up bravely, clearly, and repeatedly. I'm really curious how you found the strength to do so and to carry on.
I think that's what Grant would have wanted. I think he would have been furious that his death was being used in this way, exploited by people spreading disinformation. These are not honest people. They are spreading disinformation for their own personal enrichment, whether it's in the form of financial or social media followers or fame or whatever you want to call it. But this is being exploited, and it's a business model. And Grant would have been very upset by that. As a journalist himself and a seeker of the truth, he would certainly have wanted me to be speaking up. And also, it was really important to me to do so as a way of protecting his legacy and making sure that he was remembered for who he truly was.
That's a wonderful thought and a wonderful sentiment. Thank you. I was impressed, Celine, to learn that you're still taking care of patients at the bedside. That's so wonderful. Did that for many, many years myself. How do you integrate that, or are there conflicts with your public-facing communications work?
Yeah, so I used to do a combination of HIV and primary care in clinic, and then attending on the wards in the hospital. And what I found over time, as I started doing more and more media, is that the outpatient side of things, I think that's actually where you have the greatest impact on people's health over the course of a lifetime. It's just really hard to balance that with some of the other things that I do, because when you're in clinic, when you see patients on the outpatient side, it can bleed over to every single day of the week, any time of the day, because it's not predictable when something's going to happen. Whereas when I'm on service in the hospital, when I'm on service, I'm on service. When I'm not. And so it's a lot easier for me to say, okay, these 2 weeks I'm on service, I'm just not going to be as available, still juggling things, but still I can build around that much more easily. And that's how I found I've been able to balance things.
So that's a perfect segue, because I know that it's been tough for so many of us, particularly during the pandemic, to find that quote unquote healthy balance between home and work lives. So how do you find that appropriate balance, and what do you like to do for fun and to unwind?
I had no balance for about 3 years of the pandemic. Let's be real, I did not. And I think that sometimes you have to look at it in terms of phases of life, that this is the phase of life where this is just what I need to do and step up to what is needed. And then there are other phases of life where you can have more balance. I certainly have a lot more balance now. And I think some of this is also related to how you feel about your work. For me, I'm very passionate about my work. And so for me, my work is not the chore or onus that it might be for other people who don't love their jobs. And so I think part of it is, how do you find work that's fulfilling? And that's part of achieving the balance. What do I do for fun? I'm fortunate to live in New York City, where there is no shortage of fun things to do. I went with some female friends to see Tina Fey and Amy Poehler in a live comedy show on the Upper West Side. So I do that kind of thing. I go to the theater. There's just so many things to do in New York City. It's just, I enjoy the city.
Good for you.
Yes.
Celine, we've been asking guests to comment on the most notable changes related to infectious diseases that they've seen through their careers. So we'd love to hear your thoughts, as well as any possible predictions you may have for the future.
I think in terms of infectious disease diagnostics, we've seen really revolutionary changes where much of our therapy has been really empiric for a very long time, where we don't have an organism cultured, where we're not sure what we're treating, where we're treating syndromically. And I think that is really on the verge of dramatically changing, and has to some degree already. I think the other place where I hope we're going to make some gains is in terms of at-home testing. And we certainly saw some shifts there during the pandemic with COVID at-home testing, whether that was the rapid antigen tests or tests like Q or Lucera molecular tests that could be done at home. But I would love to see a future where those kinds of tests could be done at home in the privacy and convenience of your own home, where those test results can then trigger also much more expedient treatment, where you don't necessarily have to go to a doctor's office to get tested, to get treated. So imagine you have the flu, influenza, and you test and you're positive, and you could get that Tamiflu or Xofluza same day. Very often we miss these windows when somebody could be treated, you know, Tamiflu, Xofluza, or say Paxlovid for COVID, because we just can't get somebody into the office tested and then the prescription quickly enough. Imagine STD testing. We've seen, CDC recently came out with a report, their annual report on STDs, and we've seen increases across the board. We know from research in places like Sub-Saharan Africa that people could test themselves for HIV or STDs at home. They're much more likely to test. And I think that is not just a technological problem and challenge. It's also a regulatory one, where we're going to need the FDA to help facilitate some of these changes. And also on the manufacturing side, how can you manufacture at volume where pricing can come down and this becomes much more accessible to people?
I think it's a great vision, though, and I'm certain that industry will step up and help us get there. I think I would say that inquiring minds want to know, Celine, what most keeps you up at night these days?
Yeah, I think somebody who's very focused on public health, I mean, that's always been my first love and remains my focus. Public health depends on a functioning democracy, and a functioning democracy depends on a shared understanding of reality and the facts. And I think all of that is in real danger right now. We were talking about disinformation earlier in our conversation. I think that for me, that has risen to the top of my worries, because frankly, the rest of my work, whether it's in the hospital clinically or in public health, all of that relies on functioning government and information. And so I can't do my job if those things fall apart.
Celine, before we sign off, I'd like to give you the same opportunity that we give to all of our guests. And that is, what is the myth that you would most like to bust?
Off the top of my head, that the flu vaccine gives you the flu.
You heard it here. It does not.
It does not.
Yeah. So we've been talking today with Dr. Celine Gounder, an infectious disease and public health physician who is a public communicator par excellence. Thanks again for joining us, Celine.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's been our pleasure, I assure you. And thanks to everyone for listening to this episode of Infectious Ideas, a podcast series presented by the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases, where leading experts join us for thought-provoking conversations that lead to infectious ideas. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And if you'd like more information about NFID, please be sure to visit us online at nfid.org. Until next time.